This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, January 13, 2005. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. A ruling by the Supreme Court could lead to the deportation of tens of thousands of people to countries that do not want them or that have no recognized governments. Iraq's economic situation worsens, leading many into corruption. And no, it's not just Iraqis who are angered over the US presence on their soil. Pro-independence Hawaiians protest the illegalities associated with the American presence in Hawaii. Plus more national and international stories right after these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Sri Lankan local and international aid workers are engaged in relief efforts around the clock. Poonia Manikavasagam reports from Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
Center for National Operations of Sri Lanka said Wednesday over 31,000 people have been killed and 15,256 injured by the tsunami. The giant wave has displaced more than 200,000 families. The Sri Lankan government and the Tamil Tigers, usually political rivals, are in some places jointly engaged in humanitarian activities to assist affected people in hard-hit areas in the eastern region. But political observers say they couldn't see any prospects for a joint activity to kickstart the stalled peace process. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
We'll have more on living in the aftermath of the tsunami coming up. African leaders are holding a security summit in an effort to end some of the continent's worst armed conflicts. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
African leaders are meeting for the first time under the African Union's new Peace and Security Council, a body set up to solve numerous conflicts on the continent. One of the key issues at the summit being held this week in Gabon is how to end the crisis in Sudan's Darfur region that has claimed about 70,000 lives and displaced a million people. The African leaders will also be discussing the crisis in the Ivory Coast. Armed conflict between the Christian South and the Muslim North is threatening to split the country in two. It is unclear if the three-day security summit will find a lasting solution to some of Africa's worst crises. It is, however, significant that African leaders are beginning to take very bold steps to solve conflicts on the continent. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
In the first trial related to the Abu Ghraib torture scandal, the defense team of Charles Grainer presented testimony today, hoping to implicate others up the chain of command. From KPFT, Renee Feltz has the story.
On day number 5 of Specialist Charles Grainer's court-martial, a former military policewoman at Abu Ghraib cited two incidents when soldiers received instructions from military intelligence interrogators. In one case, Megan Amble said Grainer was told to rough up an inmate. She recalled another case when she was instructed by interrogators to sexually humiliate naked prisoners in a shower by looking at and pointing at their genitals. Amble denied Grainer was responsible for some sexual incidents he's been charged with, saying she and Grainer were surprised when they walked into a scene where prisoners were simulating oral sex. Neither of them tried to stop the incident. Grainer could be called to the stand before his court-martial ends this week. From KPFT, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
Indiana's governor canceled the union contracts of almost 25,000 state workers. Sevilla Mann reports from Richmond, Indiana.
The newly elected Republican, Mitch Daniels, announced that he would rescind an executive order granting state workers the ability to negotiate and bargain for their pay, benefits, and other terms of employment. Democratic governors had granted such orders for the 15 previous years. Eliminating negotiations with unions, the governor claimed, will enable a swift and beneficial reform of state government. Union leaders, Indiana's Black Legislative Caucus, and others have decried the governor's decree. Democrats claim it might limit state employees partaking in economic recovery that Daniels has promised, while the governor has downplayed its impact on the unions. Some claim that legal action may be possible, though an executive order and not a codified right granted the contracts. Lawmakers believe it is unlikely that legislation restoring state workers' rights to bargain would succeed in the Republican-controlled Indiana House and Senate. For Free Speech Radio News in Richmond, Indiana, I'm Sevilla Mann.
The political crisis in Bolivia is escalating as a general strike by social justice activists and indigenous communities continues in the country's two major cities. Fueling the uprisings is the presidential decree 2 weeks ago to raise petrol taxes. President Carlos Mesa said that Bolivians pay subsidized gas prices that they can ill afford, and the prior policy encouraged shortages due to smuggling of the natural resource. The activists are demanding sweeping reforms, reminiscent of the issues that brought Mesa to power 15 months ago. Evo Morales, leader of the Movement to Socialism who came in a close second in the last presidential race, is calling for an immediate election for the presidency. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
A ruling by the Supreme Court could lead to the deportation of tens of thousands of people to countries that do not want them or to countries that have no recognized governments. Human rights groups worry that the ruling could lead to the deportation of thousands of Somalis back to Somalia, where they may be either harassed or abused. Mitch Jeserich has more from Washington, D.C.
The Supreme Court ruled that the Department of Homeland Security may deport Somali-born Casey Jama back to Somalia, even though that country's government is not internationally recognized. The 25-year-old Jama, who has spent most of his life in the U.S., lost his refugee status after pleading guilty of third-degree assault. His lawyer, Jeffrey Keyes, who argued Jama's case to the Supreme Court, says deporting him to Somalia could put him in jeopardy.
It's been called the most failed of failed states. If you arrive in Mogadishu today, you'll arrive in a place that has no functioning government, no public offices. You'll arrive on a private plane, and you'll immediately be accosted by militia who will demand money from you and do what they will with you.
The Supreme Court's 5-4 decision could also lead to the deportation of over 8,000 Somalis who have deportation orders or proceedings already pending. Writing for the majority, Justice Antonin Scalia concluded that the U.S. has the right to forcibly repatriate immigrants without their country's consent. Amnesty International's Susan Benesch says the U.S. enforces tens of thousands of such deportations every year. She says many of those who have been deported have grown up in the United States.
There are countries that are now complaining that they're being flooded with people who are not part of their own societies. Even though those people are not American citizens, they are more American than anything else. And those countries are complaining to the United States that what we're doing is accepting large numbers of people into this country and then throwing back the ones we don't like as if they were fish or something.
The Supreme Court also ruled that the U.S. government cannot indefinitely detain undocumented immigrants who have committed a crime but who have already served their sentences. The case involves two Cubans who were part of the so-called Mariel boatlift, in which 920 Cubans came to the U.S. in 1980. There are over 2,000 immigrants who have served their sentences and who are still being detained. The Bush administration argued it had the right to detain such immigrants due to national security. Jack Martin with the Federation of Immigration Reform agrees.
We, in effect, deplore the situation that the American public is stuck with people who do not belong in this country simply because their governments refuse to take them back. And anyone who is familiar with the problem of recidivism knows that there has to be a risk to the American public.
But for Benesch with Amnesty International, the government shouldn't have the power to deny an immigrant due process.
These are people who came into the country without being inspected, were later convicted of some sort of crime, served their entire sentence, and then continue to sit in prison in some cases for years and years simply because the United States couldn't get their country of origin to accept them back.
Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee Arlen Specter said that he would expeditiously hold hearings in response to the Supreme Court's ruling that federal judges are not bound by mandatory sentencing guidelines. The ruling angered many congressional Republicans who say it would lead to lighter sentences for criminals. Congress will likely consider new legislation on some type of mandatory sentence. More than 64,000 people are sentenced with such guidelines every year, and the Supreme Court ruling will likely cause many to appeal their sentences. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
In its 15th annual World Report released today, Human Rights Watch highlights two developments of global concern: the large-scale ethnic cleansing in Darfur, Sudan, and the torture by detainees of U.S. forces. Jenny Johnson reports.
According to Human Rights Watch, the two major crises in Sudan and the coercive treatment policy of the U.S. toward its detainees compound the threat to human rights because the domestic and international response to them has been insufficient. Although the two situations cannot be equated, Executive Director Kenneth Ross says these situations stand out as fundamental threats to human rights.
Each is undermining the vitality of the global defense of human rights, and will continue to do so until there is a firm response.
In Darfur, 70,000 people have died and 2 million are displaced, yet the international community allows the crisis to continue. Human Rights Watch points to interference in the United Nations by China, who seeks to protect its lucrative oil interests in the region, while the U.S. was praised for championing human rights there. Roth is expecting a possible referral of the crisis to the International Criminal Court in the next few weeks.
It is something that could have an immediate effect in saving lives in Darfur. But will the Security Council vote to send Darfur to the International Criminal Court? Will China let its thirst for oil be quenched with the blood of the people of Darfur? Will the United States, which has in many respects been very strong in dealing with Darfur, will it allow its ideological opposition to the International Criminal Court stand in the way of prosecuting people who are responsible for what it calls genocide?
Beyond the scandal of torture committed at Abu Ghraib, the report called the entire coercive interrogation policy that the U.S. has pursued as systematic and having a predictable pattern, including disappearing terrorist suspects, refusal to prosecute prisoner homicides, and the approval of stress techniques that meet the criteria for cruel, inhuman, and degrading punishment. Again, Roth.
The Bush administration won't even use the language of human rights. It takes refuge in language like freedom or democracy, or the fight against terrorism. All laudable concepts, but all deliberately vague in that it doesn't require the United States to be bound by international human rights law that it up until now has applied to governments around the world.
The report also cites two controversial issues that stood out over the previous year: growing conflicts between religious communities and a global backlash against movements for the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Jenny Johnson, Free Speech Radio News.
Guerrillas today assassinated two representatives of Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, Iraq's senior Shiite cleric who's drawn fire for giving his approval of the electoral process. This comes as the Bush administration has officially announced its search for WMDs is over and yielded nothing. David Enders reports from Baghdad.
Iraqis reacted with little surprise to the news that no weapons of mass destruction had been found. The mother of Dr. Hoda Amash, one of the three weapons scientists still held without charges by the U.S. military, reacted today by saying she hoped this might finally mean the release of her daughter, who has been incarcerated for nearly 2 years. "She could have hid herself when the Americans came," Amash's mother said, but she did not think there was anything wrong. Amash's mother lamented the state of her country. "We thought the Americans would stabilize things quickly," she said. "Now look what has become of us." For Iraqis just trying to get by each day, the search was not a topic of discussion. Though government salaries have risen considerably since the beginning of the U.S. occupation, the number of government jobs has been cut severely and inflation has nearly kept pace with raises. Mahmoud Shakar is a gold dealer in the Kadmia district. He said that shortly after the war, business became much better than in the past. "However, these days," he says, "the flow of Shiite pilgrims to the shrine nearby has mostly dried up and the general economic situation is now worse than before the war."
"The economic situation is getting worse because of the security situation. If only they will get rid of the radicals."
Through the Ministry of Labor's job placement program, more than 549,000 Iraqis registered themselves as available for work from September 2003 to October 2004, according to statistics from the Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs. More than 186,000 of them were offered jobs, in many cases in government ministries, the state-run oil company, or new military units. Though the security situation is tantamount to creating instability in the economy, corruption is also a serious problem. A 50-year-old man who has to be identified as Abu Salam pushes a cart of jerry cans filled with gasoline down Jamhuriya Street, a market district in downtown Baghdad. Many Iraqis are now buying cooking gas, kerosene, and gasoline on the black market at prices nearly the same as those in the U.S., though a good wage in Iraq is $200 per month.
During the last 6 months, it's gotten very high because they sell the gasoline during the night, after curfew. The men in charge of the fuel stations pay the policemen and sell it to their friends. They bring trucks and big tanks.
Abu Salam said he received his gasoline from tanker trucks parked in a field near the town of Abu Ghraib, a southern suburb of Baghdad. He said he felt bad about the part he plays in the corruption, but said he had no other means of supporting himself, and was afraid to look for jobs in a foreign-owned company, though as the resistance continues to kill and kidnap U.S. military contractors, such jobs are increasingly hard to find as well.
There are big tanks coming from the Ministry of Oil's central storage facility. They are taking petrol and cooking gas. I make a small amount of money. I'm too afraid to even look for a job at a foreign company because my neighborhood is full of resistance. They are now writing on the walls, "Don't vote and long live the resistance."
In order to buy gasoline at state-run stations, Baghdadis wait in petrol queues stretching for kilometers. The U.S. military also said on Wednesday that the country's electrical output has fallen below pre-war levels, and most parts of the country are only receiving 3 hours of electricity each day. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
The Indonesian vice president today announced that all foreign military involved in the humanitarian operations in Aceh must leave the province in 3 months to avoid the appearance of a political intervention. The Indonesian authorities also laid out restrictions on civilian humanitarian volunteers working in the cities of Banda Aceh and Mulobho, two of the most destroyed cities. The government says the intensification of the armed clashes makes it too dangerous for foreign volunteers. The Indonesian government also reapplied the restrictive state of civil emergency procedures for humanitarian workers and journalists who want to visit Aceh, a procedure that had previously regulated foreign presence in Aceh, but had been suspended for the 2 weeks after the tsunami. From Aceh, Maggie Mariano has the story.
Official figures say the death toll in Aceh is 110,000, but many of these bodies have still not been evacuated yet. And a distribution is also still very slow, especially distribution to remote places at Western Coast. Mary Muhammad is the chairman of Indonesian Red Cross.
And you know, the first time I become panicked because all the personnel that should help also they suffered. So we should understand this condition. Including Red Scott, we suffered many persons in Aceh. I don't know how many, but I know some high-ranking Red Cross also missing, I must say. I don't know. After for this, we didn't find them.
And even though many volunteers are needed in Aceh, the Indonesian government has announced it will no longer allow a loose procedure to those volunteers who are working in Aceh. Indonesia President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono today said he will send more troops to Aceh. Andy Malarangeng is the palace spokesperson.
We are now coordinating all the volunteers. The Indonesian military's performance is now amazing. They are now everywhere.
No clear reasons has been given by the Indonesian government for these new moves. The limitations and restrictions being placed on the 1,600 foreign troops and 2,000 foreign volunteers who are now working in Aceh has been met with the dismay from the UN, the US and Australia, and also from Indonesian civilians groups. Rusti Marpaung is the coordinator of Aceh Working Group.
Kami juga bertanya-tanya gitu, apa motif dari...
We are curious about the motives of applying these new restrictions and limitations, since it was the president who originally opened up Aceh to local and international volunteers to help the people of Aceh. That makes me wonder whether the presidential policy has not been effective or whether the policy is hypocritical.
The announcement of the new restrictions come as the UN is proposing to rebuild Aceh after tsunami and have a long time of presence in Aceh. Yet, while the presence of the UN is acknowledged as being necessary by the people of Aceh, Indonesian civilian groups also criticized the UN. Again, Rudy Marpaung of Aceh Working Group.
Our experience with the UN in East Timor is that it minimizes the role of local people and local government. We also got information the people there did not have a chance to participate in decision-making about what is best for them. For example, when the UN organized the tsunami conference in Jakarta last week, it excluded the participation of affected people, even from the Achenese community.
The U.S. will mobilize its A warships and prepare its 13,000 troops who are around Aceh for humanitarian walks to leave as soon as the time limit over. Brigadier General Christian Caudry, the U.S. vice senior military officer in Indonesia, said the U.S. is only in Aceh for humanitarian walk. Some Muslim groups are worried that the involvement of U.S. troops in Aceh will open the way for a U.S. intervention on Aceh land. From disaster site in Aceh, Maggie Margiono reporting for Free Speak Radio News.
In Hawaii, Senator John McCain's opposition to the Native Hawaiian Federal Recognition Bill is meeting with mixed reactions. Hawaiians support the bill through state agencies like the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, and they're working with the Republican Governor Linda Lingle to change McCain's mind. But McCain's remarks have spurred criticism from pro-independence Hawaiians who are becoming more vocal about the violations of international law by the United States and the illegalities associated with the American presence in Hawaii. Anne Kiala Kelly reports.
Senator John McCain, who replaced retired Senator Ben Nighthorse as head of the Indian Affairs Committee, announced last week his opposition to a bill known as the Akaka-Stevens Bill, which proposes to federally recognize Native Hawaiians. McCain cited an agreement in the Statehood Act that implies Native Hawaiians should not receive the same status as Native Americans. But speaking by phone from her Connecticut home, Dr. J. Keholani Kawanui, assistant professor in American Studies and Anthropology at Wesleyan University, had sharp criticism for the senator. While Kawanui is one of many Hawaiians who oppose the bill, she says the premise of McCain's opposition is incorrect.
Senator McCain had the nerve to tell the reporter that when Hawaii attained statehood, there was an implicit agreement at the time that Native Hawaiians would not receive the same status as Native Americans. For Hawaii to even be admitted to the Union under U.S. federal terms, Hawaiian entitlements were to be protected by the U.S. federal government and the state of Hawaii. Native Hawaiians were specifically named. The special designation of Native Hawaiians as beneficiaries shows that Hawaiians are entitled to benefits as Hawaiians over and above any benefit as state citizens.
The entitlements Kawanui refers to are tied to the so-called ceded lands, which comprise almost 2 million acres that came under U.S. control 7 years after a U.S.-backed military coup by white missionary descendants overthrew the Hawaiian Kingdom in 1893. The Land Claims Settlement Act, certain to follow passage of any bill that federally recognizes Hawaiians, is, in large part, what makes this bill so controversial. Kawanui explains that while the land is a public trust, there was never a legal transfer of title to the United States.
These lands were kingdom, crown, and government lands, and our sovereignty claims exposed the lack of U.S. federal title to these lands in the first place.
At a weekly meeting of Kapa Kaukau in Honolulu, McCain's announcement was discussed by Native and non-Native sovereignty advocates like Maivan Klet Lam, professor at CUNY, specializing in Indigenous peoples' rights under international law.
Nobody wants to be a Native American, not even Native Americans. They want to be in their own self-determining nations. And I've always considered it disingenuous for the Hawaii congressional delegation to say, quick, sign on to the Akaka bill, because otherwise you won't have any funds for your needs. They know perfectly well that their colleagues on the Republican side are busy shutting down the nation within the nation concept. So it's as if the Democratic delegation were begging you to quickly enter into this house called Nation Within the Nation, on top of the roof of which the Republicans are about to bring down a sledgehammer. And so the whole game was never to preserve entitlements, but to essentially get a quit claim of your independence.
Also in attendance at the meeting was Terry K. Ko'olani, member of Nuclear Free and Independent Pacific and advocate for Native Hawaiian independence. She says McCain's opposition to the bill is for the wrong reasons.
I think the reality for us is that we have to defeat the Akaka bill for the right reasons. We don't want to be under the plenary powers of the United States of America. We don't have to create a Native American entity to talk about and pursue our rights as Native Hawaiian people.
As the Hawaii congressional delegation attempts to move this bill through Congress in 2005, many Hawaiians appear poised to articulate the legal and historical evidence of their rights for more than what federal recognition would ever provide. For Free Speech Radio News in Honolulu, I'm Ann Keala Kelly.
Across the United States, low and moderate income households are having a harder time finding affordable housing. In the last 5 years, rental rates in Washington, D.C. have increased 4 times faster than income levels, leading many out into the streets to protest. Amna Kazmi from the D.C. Radio Co-op reports.
Who are we?
D.C. residents.
What do we want?
Affordable housing.
When do we want it?
Now!
This week, D.C. advocates for affordable housing, representing almost 50 community groups, delivered signed postcards to D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams. The advocates demanded the mayor support a change in D.C. zoning laws, which would balance real estate development while keeping affordable housing. Although housing advocates were unable to meet with the mayor himself, they were invited to speak with a representative. Mary Spencer from D.C. Acorn read from the postcard, signed by over 2,000 city residents.
Dear Mayor Williams, I am writing to urge you to support the campaign for inclusionary zoning's amendment to the zoning regulations that would establish mandatory inclusionary zoning in the District of Columbia. The proposal will produce affordable housing for low and moderate income workers, support the creation of mixed income communities, prevent displacement of low and moderate income residents, leverage the expertise and a capability of private developers to build affordable housing.
Cities such as Boston and San Francisco have adopted mandatory inclusionary zoning. Policy advocates say these cities have generated equitable housing distribution in diverse communities. Nina Daster from the Center for Community Change, who authored the proposed amendment in D.C., says both developers and families benefit from the adoption of these kinds of policies.
With the economic revitalization of the city, housing prices have been skyrocketing. So low and moderate income residents are being displaced from their neighborhoods or can't afford to live in the city at all. What the policy requires is that when buildings of more than 10 units are being developed, a certain percentage of those units have to be set aside to be affordable to low and moderate income residents. And what that means is that a teacher who is teaching in the neighborhood can afford to live in the community where her students live.
In Washington, the campaign for mandatory inclusionary zoning was spurred by D.C.'s rapid real estate boom, where the average D.C. family would need an annual salary of $85,000 a year to purchase a home, $30,000 more than it would make in a year. For Free Speech Radio News, with Ingrid Drake, this is Amna Kazmi.
For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.